You could almost imagine somebody worked really hard choosing those songs to fit in with what we've been looking at. I'm sure they did, so thank you very much indeed. If you have a Bible, I'm going to say the opposite of this morning. It would be great if you could turn, please, to 1 Samuel chapter 17. I'm very, very aware, for legitimate reasons, that there are people who are here tonight who were not able to be here this morning. And there are people who were here this morning, and this morning seems a long time ago. And so I thought we'd just begin by catching up on what we looked at this morning. We said that in 1 Samuel chapter 17, somebody who is going to be hugely used by God is stepping up a level in their availability to God. They are entering what we call this morning a defining moment. The David who walked away from the encounter with Goliath was a very different David in some ways than the one who walked towards that encounter, at least as far as people were concerned. The whole trajectory of David's life changed that day. As we're going to see next week, his public profile went off the Richter scale. He becomes one of the most successful, recognized, high-profile people in the land of Israel. But David had no way of knowing that when on this particular morning he got up and just did more or less what he always did. We said this morning that defining moments do not usually come with pre-announcements. They don't come with lights flashing and flags waving and bells ringing and this choice is going to change the whole course of your life. We also mentioned this morning that many defining moments in the Bible are initiated by God. God steps into somebody's world and it's almost as though he throws a breaker switch in the universe and everything changes for them. So we thought about Samuel and Saul of Tarsus and Peter on the beach at Galilee, etc. But this defining moment, from one point of view, is initiated by David. In other words, David makes some choices that change the whole course of his life. And it's interesting that this takes place in the context of him facing a problem. And we said that this morning that although the particulars of the events of 1 Samuel 17 are unique, in a class of their own, never repeated again, quite like this, the principles involved in this chapter are universal. And whenever you meet somebody who God is using in an outstanding way, and you get to know them, and you get behind the kind of public persona, you'll find many of the principles that we're looking at here. And so we said we were going to look at two things. We said, first of all, we would explore the kind of problems that key players almost always encounter. So we're going to look at the problems facing David. And we didn't quite finish this morning, so we'll round that off. And then we said we would explore a key player facing problems. This morning we notice, first of all, that the kind of issues that David encountered would come under the heading of overwhelming problems. In other words, here is a situation that David cannot handle in his own strength. Nobody in Israel, in their own strength, could take on Goliath. Goliath is huge, he won't go away, he's there day after day and week after week. As are sometimes the kind of problems that we face personally. But then we also look this morning at the fact that actually it wasn't just an individual who was facing these problems. In 1 Samuel 17 it was the people of God. It was the corporate people of God who were facing overwhelming problems. And we talked about some of the problems facing evangelical churches in the first part of the 21st century today. I wonder how many churches lack, in the eyes of the world, credibility and lack relevance. I know very little about your church, but I would encourage those of you who come regularly here to ask the question, do we have credibility in the eyes of non-Christians? How many people beat a path to our door to find out what we think about something? When there's an issue in Carlisle, are people ringing up? Are the media contacting us? Because we have such incredible credibility that they want to find out what we think about something. Credibility gives us a voice. Relevance gives us a language. And we noticed this morning how few evangelical churches in the UK have both credibility and relevance. I didn't use those words, but that was kind of where I was going with looking at those statistics around the average church in an average English city. So, overwhelming problems. But then we also noticed on a far more subtle level that David, like all key players, is finding his energy and his vision and his belief that things can change being leached away. And we looked at two things. We noticed, first of all, ridicule from the enemy, where Goliath is ridiculing the people of God, and when David steps up, he is ridiculing David. And Satan will do that in our lives. Do you think you can make a difference? Do you think you can change anything? Do you think the world is going to be a different place when you leave than when you came? Ridicule from the enemy. Then we close this morning by looking at discouragement from an older believer. Saul, who is the leader, Saul, who is the king, actually says almost exactly the same words to David as Goliath is going to say to him. You don't think you can do anything about this situation? You know, wake up and smell the coffee, kid. You can make no change whatsoever. And I ended this morning, I didn't use these words, but I tried to point out that very often non-Christians are more encouraging than Christians. That's why I told the story about the pastor when he was a young man who went to a leader at church and asked him to pray about something. And the leader at church said, "Dream on, kid. Dream on, young man. We'd all like something like that. It doesn't happen." And then a non-Christian breathed hope and a future into him that a Christian didn't. That's where we got to this morning. And I want just to round off the kind of problems facing a key player by looking at verse 28. We didn't read it tonight, although we read it this morning. Just to put this in its context, Saul apparently has said, any soldier who will face Goliath and take him out, here is how I will reward him. At least that's what the soldiers were saying. Whether Saul had actually said that, or this was just a rumour, or whatever, you pay your money and you take your choice. But there were these fantastic statements being made by the soldiers. And 1 Samuel 17:28, David is asking them, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on? When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked him, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Here's the third undermining pressure. Criticism from a brother. Somebody who looks at David and totally misreads his motives. How easy it is for us to look at other people and think we know why they're doing what they're doing. I mean, most of us don't even understand our own motives, if the truth be known. If you dig deep enough through the onion levels, through the onion skin levels. Look at all the missiles in this little speech that Eliab says to David. With whom did you leave those few sheep? You are useless. We can't trust you to do anything. Did you abandon them? Who did you leave them with? You are just this lazy little guy that none of us can trust. I know how conceited you are. What an offensive statement to David. Here is God who says, in the New Testament, is recorded as saying, I found David, a man after my own heart. And here are his brothers who just think he's a little big head. I know how wicked your heart is. You only came down to watch the battle. You're a lying little toad. You're claiming to do one thing when really you're doing something else. Wow. key players often are completely misread by other people. And I would encourage us to take two things from that. Number one, to be very, very, very careful what we say to other people. To be extremely careful what we say to other people. Rob, is there not a place for challenging people? Absolutely. Is there not a place for helping people work out their motives? Absolutely. But Jesus models how we should do that. With the plank and the little speck of sawdust deal. Before I dare go and start judging anybody else, I jolly well better spend a long time looking in the mirror myself. I better recognize how prone to blowing it I am. It's very interesting that these guys who are talking against David are actually describing what was true of them. No intention of fighting in the battle. No intention of trusting God, and yet passing opinions about everybody else. It's interesting that if we're not careful, we start to mouth the accusations of the enemy against people, thinking we're actually doing God's work. I found it very challenging when one time I realized, when you look at the book of Job, we go backstage in the heavenlies. When we look at the opening passages in the book of Job. And here is Satan bringing accusations against Job. He's saying to God, this guy only serves you because you protect him. His heart's not what it seems. He's not really what he seems. Who is it who says that to Job? We talk about the condemnation of the enemy, the accusation of the enemy rather. Who is it who says that to Job in space and time? It's his religious friends who say to him what Satan has been accusing him of in the heavenlies. Key players know all about that. About people completely misreading their motives. And not being backward at voicing it. Last week I used an illustration from my own life. Maybe I'll use another illustration from my own life. And whenever I do that, I kind of leave myself wide open to being misunderstood. But that's okay. I'm in a church one day and a guy comes to me at the end. It always blows me away when people feel in church we have a right to go up to a complete stranger and just give them our opinion of them. I mean, Steve Brady once said to me, if people in the big wide world did what they do in church, they'd wake up with a crowd around them. Because somebody would nut them. Somebody would stick one on them. But in the church, especially if we introduce it by, I'm saying this in love, brother. Oh, really? Whenever anybody says that to me, I think I'm about to get a knee in the groin. Any moment now, here it comes. Big time. This guy comes up to me and says, can you take a word of constructive criticism? I said, no, not really. He just ploughs on, straight through. He says, in my opinion, you walk around too much when you're speaking. Oh, thank you for that helpful remark. Yeah, I do walk around a lot, and I do it for a number of reasons, and I've thought a lot about why I do it. Probably with respect more than you've thought about it, having seen me for 5 minutes and then come out with that critique. And I said something to him, I'm not proud of this, it just kind of came out. And one of my daughters said to me afterwards, Dad, I couldn't believe you said that. I said, well, it's been a lousy week and, you know, there you go. I said to him, can you take a word of constructive criticism? I said, I want to tell you how many miles I've driven to be with you guys. It's a round journey of 400 miles. And the Inland Revenue evaluate the cost of my car at 45 pence a mile. So it's cost me round about 180 quid. This isn't you, by the way. You guys are magnificent. I have to say that. Just before we go on any further. You really are. I'm not just saying that. I am blown away by the kindness and generosity that you show me. But you are kind of not... Pardon? And you love it, thank you very much, Freddie. I said 45 pence a mile, 400 miles, is around about 180 quid. I said, I will have been with you for 3 days. Away from home, 3 days, with you guys for 3 days, plus all the preparation it took. Let's round that off, minimum hourly payment. That comes to about another 180 quid. If this was a hotel as opposed to the kind of sleeping bag deal that we've got going, if somebody had given me two nights in a hotel, I don't know, you'd be looking about, I don't know, maybe 100 quid or something. Let's do the maths. That lot comes to 460 quid. Can you take a word of constructive criticism? Your little mate's going to do the brown envelope deal at the end, which feels like a drug deal's going down. Somebody comes up to you, you know, thank you for being here, and there's some brown envelope mysteriously appears in your hand. When I get home and I open it, there'll be 10 quid in it. Can you take a word of constructive criticism? You know, hey man, live in the real world. It is so easy to deal it out and not be prepared to get it back. Criticism from somebody you should have known better. We need to be really careful what we say to others, and also we need to be careful how we listen to others. Not everybody who comes to you and questions your motives or starts to tell you what you should be doing, not all of those are speaking from the Lord. Some of them are, and a lot of them are not. At Cape and Ray, one of the things we do, and I love doing it, it's kind of funny, is we ask the students, we have a thing called Student Voice, where representatives from all the small groups of students get together and give us feedback about how we run Cape and Ray, and it is hilarious. I love listening to it. I mean, I got to write it down, and we've got to think about it, and wherever we can action it. But I learned that much of their feedback is more a window into their heart than anything objective about Cape and Ray that they're saying. Sometimes they come up with great stuff, I'm not denying that, but very often it's showing us where they are parked up rather than where we should be heading. The pressures facing a key player. Overwhelming problems and undermining pressures. But I wanted tonight to focus more on this key player facing problems. And if God is going to use you, in one way or other, you will face these principles, sooner or later. And I've split them into two. First of all, what David did not do, which might seem a bit of a backwards way around of looking at it, what he didn't do. He probably didn't do 1,000 things, yeah, but there's a couple of things that I think are significant. And then we're going to look at what he did do. Here's the first thing that he doesn't do. And I love this. He does not surrender to the surrounding apathy. He refuses to let the environment define what he believes God can do. Because he has come to a situation where it looks like everybody's really trusting God. So we have all of these people dressed for battle. That's what it says. We have all of these people drawing up the battle lines. So it sounds like, hey, something's about to kick off. Then they start to cry the battle cries. It looks like they really mean business. The truth is, none of them have the slightest intention of moving outside of their comfort zone. It is going to be same old, same old, same old, same old, same old for as long into the future as anybody can see. And David refuses to buy into that scenario. Hey, that's kind of interesting. I find that challenging. I read about this a long time ago, and so I did some research, and it's true that psychologists have noticed what soldiers do oftentimes in a battle when the situation is overwhelming and there's just not much that you can do about it. Oh, so here's a small group of soldiers and they've got cut off from their unit and maybe they're in a very shallow dugout and there's three or four of them and the enemy is closing in on them. Do you know often what happens? The technical term, but it's not complicated. The technical term for describing what often happens is escape sleep. They actually fall asleep. Which you think, whoa, I wouldn't think that would happen. Believe me, that happens a lot. Why would you fall asleep in an impossible situation? Just to tune it out. Just to stop looking at it. Just to disconnect from it. Because the situation is so lousy, I don't want to be here. And maybe you've experienced that in your own life. You know, when a student comes to me and says, oh, I'm really tired. I am so tired. I can't stay awake. You know, you don't know what tired is. Now, it might be that they went to sleep about 4 a.m. That's a distinct possibility. Or it might be that they're struggling with something And it's much easier to say, oh, I'm really tired. And you feel really tired. And I just want to tune it out. David refuses to surrender to the surrounding apathy. Key players will not embrace the status quo. And I'm sure you know this, status quo is Latin for the mess that we're in. Not really. So he refuses to settle for the surrounding apathy. The second thing that he will not do, which I think is wonderful, is he won't allow other people to force him into their mould. I'm sure you saw that in the text that was read for us. I mean, it's a little bit ridiculous, but here is Saul insisting that David wears his armour. So 1 Samuel 17:38, then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armour on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried to walk around. The message that we read this morning said he attempted to move around, but he couldn't do. Why not? Well, there's a very obvious reason why not. We read early on in the book of Samuel that Saul was head and shoulders bigger than the biggest man in Israel. So Saul was a lot bigger than David. So when you stick Saul's armour on David, no wonder he tried to move around and couldn't do. I'm sure David took two paces and the armour didn't move. And then he turned around and nothing's moving on the outside. Why? Because the armour didn't work for him. Guess what? The armour didn't work for Saul either. Saul, this is kind of ridiculous, really. It's kind of farcical. You could laugh at this stuff. Here is a guy who hasn't the slightest intention of taking on Goliath, telling the only person in the congregation who's at least willing to give it a shot how he should be doing it. I mean, I have no intention whatsoever of going into that bar and trying to reach people. I haven't the slightest intention of going on a counselling course and understanding how to unpack some of the complexities in people's lives. But here's me who's not doing it, telling you who wants to do it, how you should be doing it. And I can imagine David feeling, would you please give me a great big break? Why should I allow you, who hasn't the remotest intention of doing anything, telling me who has, how I should be doing it? But the church is full of that scenario. And key players, when you sit down and talk to them, have usually had a big battle working through that. You may have heard the story about D.L. Moody. Moody, you know, the kind of first great mass evangelist, a bit like Billy Graham, but not as eloquent or polished as Billy Graham, but used mightily by God. At the end of an evangelistic address, would invite people to stand up and come down the aisles and stand at the front if they wanted to know how to become a Christian. And Moody would do that. And one day a mid-heavyweight theologian came up to him and challenged him about what he did at the end of meetings and was giving him this deal. And he said, I don't like the way you challenge people to respond to the gospel. I can see all kinds of problems with it. And Moody said, well, I can see some problems with it as well. How do you do it? And the man said to him, oh, I don't do it. And Moody said to him, well, I like the way I do it better than the way you don't do it. And I'm not saying that we should bury our heads or we should let people do stupid things. But if I see people who are trying to be obedient to God, who are trying to reach the lost, who are trying to do stuff, I will give them a lot more credibility than people who are not trying even to do it. It's amazing how many churches I go to that long for things to change. You know, if only we had more young people, if only we've seen more people come to Jesus, if only, if only, if only, if only, if only. In other words, we long for things to change. And then when somebody suggests something changing, the effluent hits the cooling system. There's problems. You know, just unpack that little statement and then never ask me back again, all right? Seriously. Because we all want things to change until somebody changes something. Then we don't want anything to change. I know some of you heard this story before, so just kind of politely smile and think, oh, Rob's kind of out of touch. I heard a fascinating story a long time ago about a couple who got married. And the husband notices that whenever his wife is putting the joint of meat in the oven for Sunday lunch, she cuts a couple of inches off the end before she puts it in the oven. And so he says to her, I've noticed, why do you do that? Why do I do what? Why do you always cut a couple of inches off the end of the meat? She says, well, I've always done it. He says, well, yeah, I know, but why are you doing it? Then she says, because my mum does it. Well, why does she do it? I have no idea. She just always has done it that way. Why? I don't know why. I mean, what's this why thing? I don't know why. Well, let's ring her and let's find out. So they ring the mum up, and her response is, what's the problem? Why do you always cut a couple of inches of meat off before you put it in the oven? She says, well, why wouldn't I? You know, but why are you doing it? Don't tell us why you wouldn't do it. Why are you doing it? And she says, because I've always done it. Yes, but why? Well, because my mum did it that way. But why did she do it that way? I have no idea. What is the problem? The problem is, why are you doing it? Why do we hold a meeting at 6:30 on a Sunday night? What do you mean, why? You know, why? Why do we hold meetings the way we hold? Why are you asking why? Why do we sing the songs we sing? What is it with this why? Back off with the why. Key players often rock the boat by asking why. So they ring the grandmother. And we go through the whole scenario again. Why do you do it? And she says, because I've only got a small baking tray, and so I have to cut it off to put it. Things that begin for an intelligent reason finish up being invested with the non-negotiable, you know, eternal truths of the Trinity, and God protect anybody who says, why? David refuses to just go along with the status quo. And he refuses to allow other people to insist on how he does things. Here's what David does do, and with this we're going to close. I love this. This is kind of now the other side of the equation. Because it may seem as though I've been giving Saul and David's brothers and leaders generally a tough time, and giving the impression if some crazy young person comes along with a stupid idea, just go along with it. That's not what I'm saying at all. Because one of the things that I love is that David brings into this mega situation principles he's been applying in his life for years. David steps up, and there's stuff that David is doing that's beautiful. David doesn't know this is a defining moment. David is not acting any different this day than any other day. Here's what's built into the life of this key player. Number one, humility and reliability. I love that. That's kind of part of David's DNA. So humility and reliability, number one, to his dad. How many brothers do they have? Lots of brothers. How many sons had gone away to the battle? Three. Can you imagine this being lots of houses, you know? And Jesse gets David and says, I want you to take these pizzas to your brothers. Why should I have to take them? Hey, why are we looking at me? Well, why am I supposed to be doing this? You know, in some homes, if somebody leaves a cup of tea, an empty cup of tea on the sideboard, it'll be there in 4 weeks' time. And you say to somebody, would you please move that? It's not my cup of tea. Why should I move it? I didn't leave it there. What are you telling me to move it for? That's not the attitude that comes off David. Now, David was the son of an Ephrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was old and well advanced in years. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to the war. So there are 5 sons at home. And David does not kick off when his dad asks him to do something that really anybody could have done. You see the same attitude when he talks to Saul. 1 Samuel 17:32, David said to Saul, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. Or when Saul is questioning, who is this guy? And at the end of the encounter, 1 Samuel 17:58, whose son are you, young man? Saul asked him. David said, I am the son of your servant, Jesse of Bethlehem. There is a lovely servant heart about David. He's not a fight waiting to happen. He's not somebody who's obnoxious because he likes being obnoxious. He won't bend to stuff that nobody should be saying okay to, but there isn't an arrogant attitude in him. There's a beautiful servant heart about him. He hadn't actually abandoned the sheep, which is what his brothers accused him of. Chapter 17, 20, early in the morning, David left the flock with a shepherd. When he arrives at the battlefield and he hears what's going on, he left the things with the keeper of the supplies. There is a reliability in David that's beautiful. I know you've heard this many, many times before, but let me read it to you. It's about four or five people who have names like anybody, nobody, everybody, somebody, etc. One day there was a job that needed doing. Anybody could have done it. But nobody realized that everybody wouldn't do it. Everybody said that somebody should do something, but nobody realized that everybody would do nothing. As a result, a job that could have been done by anybody was left to everybody so that nobody did what somebody should have done. And here is David willing to do a very humble job with a servant attitude, and that's what led him to his defining moment. There was no ticket saying, today is going to change your life. Today, if you are servant-hearted, today, if you're 100% reliable in everything you do, guess what? You're going to be the most famous person in Israel this time tomorrow. There was no ticket saying that. And day after day and week after week, that's been David's life choice. And then one day it leads him to this defining moment. Just this humility and reliability. Secondly, I want to suggest that what we see in David is strategy. David is not afraid to use his mind. He's not just going off on one. So, for instance, did you notice that three times he says, what will happen to the man who kills this Philistine? He hears the guy speaking, he goes and says, what was that about? And they tell him. And his brothers kick in and he says, hey, what is the big deal with you guys? He doesn't get in an argument with them. He just kind of tunes them out and he says, come on, run it by me one more time. What will happen to the man who kills this Philistine? David is the kind of guy who's making absolutely sure of facts before he does anything. This is the kind of person he was. I'm sorry if this kind of steps on people's toes, all right? But I don't know how many sermons you've heard. I have heard so many sermons on this spirit-guided stone that David threw. You know, sermons on Goliath and the kind of helmets they had and the little slot at the front and how hard it was to get the stone in the slot. So this is kind of God stepping in and supernaturally guiding this stone. Well, maybe. Or maybe it is significant that these eastern shepherds could hit a reed at 20 meters. You know why? Because day after day, week after week, month after month, they're practicing with a sling and a stone. And when David steps into this defining moment, stuff that he has built into his life for years comes online. There is nothing ungodly in strategy, in using our mind, in reading books, in asking ourselves a question like this: are there any other churches in the United Kingdom who are very similar to us, who have our ethos, who have our core values, but who are doing a better job than we are in ABC, whatever ABC happens to be? We don't have to reinvent the wheel. Maybe we could send some leaders down to sit down with those leaders and say, listen, you are like we are, you're just a bit further along the road. What can we learn from you? Key players are not afraid of doing that. They are not threatened by people saying there's a better way of doing it than you're doing it. I mean, I wonder if you, how you feel when I say that. You know, we think of right and wrong, good and bad. And we're always, you know, well, if we're not doing good, then we're doing bad. No. You might be doing brilliant, but you can do even better. And somebody who wants to see God moving things on to another level is not afraid of asking difficult questions and saying, is there anybody we can learn from? Is there any book we can read? Is there any, you know, stuff that we can access that would help us? David is characterized by humility and reliability that didn't just appear this day. He's characterized by strategy. And finally, and this is what we've heard all the sermons on, so I'm not going to camp on this, he's characterized by security in God. He truly trusts God. Somebody has said that there are three levels of faith. And it's quite interesting to think about this. First of all, there is public faith. Public faith is what I want you to think that I believe. And this is kind of the particular domain of people who are paid to preach, full-time Christian workers, etc. That we are so afraid of saying what we really think. So we'll say what people think we should really think. Lest, you know, some missiles come in our direction. Public faith. Of saying what we think other people think we should believe. That's public. Then we have, secondly, private faith. That's what we genuinely, sincerely think we believe. Okay? So here's Simon Peter speaking to Jesus. Although everybody abandons you, I'll never abandon you. And he really believed that's what he thought. He really believed that was him. And then there is core value faith. Core value faith is what I truly believe deep down inside. Do you know how to tell what you truly believe deep down inside? The New Testament gives us that crystal clear. Just look at how you do life. How, Rob, you do life, how you spend money, how you invest your time, how you respond to situations is a window into what you truly believe, not what you say you believe or what you even think you believe. It is our works, it is our life choices that show what we really believe. And here is Saul talking about the Lord. The Lord be with you, he says to David. The Message paraphrased that, if we'd read it this morning, God help you. Which you could read two ways, couldn't you? God help you as you go and face that. The Lord be with you. Because I won't be with you, but we'll be watching from a safe distance and trust you, make it okay. David was the only person who was secure enough in God to move completely outside of his comfort zone. He's a key player stepping up. And he does not develop this trust in God on the battlefield. He develops this trust in God 24/7 in ordinary situations. Although actually fighting a lion and a bear is probably not what we define as an ordinary situation. I wanted to share two stories and then we're through. I guess like me, many of you really enjoyed the Olympics. I thought they were fantastic. I love them. And my mind went back to a previous Olympics and to a previous American swimmer, a guy called Mark Spitz, who won 7 gold medals in 1 Olympic Games. And I remember him being interviewed on British TV about his training regime. I mean, how cool would it be to stand there with the flag going up and the national anthem playing and hand on the heart deal and 7 medals, isn't this great? I think we'd all like that. I'd like that, it'd be great. And he described his training regime. He said, in training for these Olympic Games, I swam the equivalent of twice around the world. Fancy that? This is David. This is a key player. This is somebody stepping into the public arena who, when nobody has been there, has been reliable, has been humble, has been smart, has been trusting God when nobody's been there. I used to watch a program on the TV. It was called Superstars. And it's not been on for years and years and years and years and years. And it was a kind of an athletics competition where people from different athletic disciplines came together, and the rules were a bit complicated. You weren't allowed to compete in a part of the competition that played to your own discipline. So if you were a runner and there was a running race, you couldn't enter that. If you were a footballer and there was a penalty shootout, you weren't allowed to enter that. Well, I remember watching the final of European Superstars, where they had got the winners from all of these individual European countries and they came together. And we've come to the final event. And there are two guys on equal points. One is an Austrian and the other was an English hurdler called David Hemery. And the final event was running twice around this field. And just before you got to the finishing straight, there was a hurdle and there was some water on the other side of the hurdle. Now, because David Hemery was a hurdler, but he had to take part in this final event because there's two of them on equal points, they started him half a lap behind everybody else. So everybody lines up and then you look over the other side of the track and there's David Hemery stood on his own. The starting pistol's fired, they run once round, they run almost twice round, and they're coming to this final hurdle, and now David Hemery is neck and neck with this Austrian guy. And they go over the hurdle, and Hemery catches his foot on top of the hurdle, and falls very awkwardly into the water. He comes out of the water jump, he runs down the finishing straight, and then he collapses as he's crossed the finishing line. And his coach runs over to him and is looking at his ankle, and the cameras zoom in and his ankle's ballooning out. And then they show you the fall again. And they show you in slow motion. He's coming up to the final hurdle. He goes over, he falls and splashes into the water. He comes out of the water and they freeze frame on his face. And on his face are two things. Number one, agony, as he realizes what he's done to his ankle. And the second thing etched into his face is total determination to finish. It's not because there are millions of people watching on the TV. It's because day after day, week after week, month after month, when nobody's there, he's got out of bed and run round a crummy circuit. When it didn't feel very good, and what's this accomplishing? Hey, welcome to people who make an impact. People who, when nobody's watching, are servant-hearted, are totally reliable, are smart and ask awkward questions and practice and practice and practice and practice and practice to become excellent at what they do. And people who learn in the everyday of life to truly trust God. A key player steps up. And the David who walks away from this defining moment, without perhaps realizing it at the time, has entered a completely different phase of his life. And we're going to look next week at what that felt like.